All right, we are studying the minor prophets, particularly Micah, right now. And I'm on page 24 of my book, which is actually not from Micah at all. It's from 1 Kings, and part of it's from 2 Kings. And this is the story of Naboth's vineyard. Now, we've been talking about the fact that what happened in the 8th century in Israel was that the kings became corrupt. They appointed judges who were corrupt, and businessmen who were corrupt began to change the way that God had set up Israel to care for its neighbor. They began to eliminate the fact that land was a permanent possession for families. And so they began to take away permanently land from people. They began to glean the edges of the field. They began to harvest all their edges and borders, and did not allow for the various methods that God had used so that the poor could at least come and work in order to earn enough for their daily bread. They began to do all kinds of things in the courts of law to steal that, take that which belongs to others. And so this became systemic in the kingdom of Israel. The time-honored traditions that God had put in their place were abandoned. And so it happened at a pretty high level. Once that happened and it began to permeate the ordinary common man, because what they see at the top is what they replicate, then the nation pretty much gave itself over to abandoning its neighbor and for the sake of consumerism, for getting wealthy, so that they might have what they want at the expense of their neighbor. And this particular event we're going to read about is just a classic example of what we're talking about. The main message of the prophets was that God's people, especially their leaders, must demonstrate love for their neighbor. Their message was a clarion call to social justice. The saga of Naboth's vineyard is a prime example of the systemic and cultural injustice that abounded in Israel that caused God to send the prophets and to eventually prescribe exile as a necessary retribution for the sins of the community of God's people, as outlined so eloquently in Micah and his peers. Social justice, we have a tendency to relate to that term based on where we're coming from. If we are a minority of some kind, social justice says to us someone is going to help us get out of our hole. Someone's going to give us a boost up, maybe even a preferential treatment in order to level out the field. If we come from the upper class or the people who have it, social justice may invoke in us the sense that somebody's going to steal something from us. We don't need to be concerned so much about what the term means in our culture, but we do need to be concerned about what it means in our Bible. Social justice is something that God demands of us. So when we read the stuff in the newspaper about various issues, like, for instance, there's an article this morning about the Supreme Court going to look at the affirmative action issues and whatever in order to come up with whether they're going to challenge whether or not affirmative action is appropriate anymore, or at least appropriate in all places anymore. And when we read all of that, we need to disconnect from our cultural biases, wherever they are, no matter which side of the aisle we're on, and try to think and sense what God would want in that scenario. It's not as simple as it looks sometimes. Sometimes what we have to do is quit being right or left and be Christian. We have to quit being Democratic or Republican and be a Christian, an evangelical believer. And that means that sometimes we're going to come down on the side of one group and sometimes we're going to come down on the side of the others. When we get to heaven and we begin to deal with the Lord, he's not going to ask us which party we voted for or whether or not we did this or that. So, social justice. 1 Kings 21:1. It came about after these things that Naboth the Jezreelite had a vineyard, which was in Jezreel beside the palace of Ahab, king of Samaria. And Ahab spoke to Naboth and said, "Give me your vineyard that I may have it for a vegetable garden, because it is close beside my house," you mean palace, "and I will give you a better vineyard than it in its place. If you like, I will give you the price of it in money." But Naboth said to Ahab, "The Lord forbid me that I should give you the inheritance of my fathers." Remember that in Israel, land was given to people and passed down from generation to generation so that there would never be a permanent underclass in Israel. And if someone lost their land, it was not permanent. There were mechanisms to get that land back for their descendants so that the mistakes of one generation could not wipe out the prospects of the other. Naboth said, "The Lord forbid me that I should give you the inheritance of my fathers." So Abraham came to his house, sullen and vexed, because the word which Naboth the Jezreelite had spoken to him. And he said, "I will not give you the inheritance of my fathers." That just caused him to pout. He lay down on his bed, turned away with his face, and ate no food. But Jezebel, his wife, came to him and said, "How is it that your spirit is so sullen that you're not eating food?" So he said to her, "Because I spoke to Naboth the Jezreelite and said to him, 'Give me your vineyard for money, or else if it pleases you, I'll give you a vineyard in its place.' But he said, 'I will not give you my vineyard.'" Ahab is the very weak son of King Omri. King Omri was one of the absolute worst kings that was ever in Israel. And he had all manner of abominable practices. And he had a weak son who was going to become king after him, and he figured he needed to fix that. So he went to Sidon, which was a business partner, and he obtained the daughter of the Sidonian king, Jezebel, who was a witch priestess for the goddess Astarte. And she was one wicked woman. We all have heard the term Jezebel, and it evokes somebody who's bad at some level. And she was. She was the person for whom all that's named. And so he married this Jezebel to his weak-kneed son so that his son would have strength in his home when he was king over Israel and not lose it, because he didn't trust that his son could stand up. He was probably right. Ahab's summer palace in Jezreel bordered on a vineyard belonging to Naboth, and Ahab wanted it for a vegetable garden. But Naboth would not sell his land because it was inheritance from his fathers. So Ahab went home and pouted on his bed. Now, it's unlikely that Ahab would ever step foot in this vegetable garden. I'm sure he would have a garden like many of us do. I have a garden, but my wife tills it, you know. Well, his wife wasn't going to till it, but someone would do it for him, and then he would brag about his garden. And he could look out of his window and see his garden and just be thrilled about that. Of course, it would only cost this man his inheritance and his descendants their inheritance for all the days of their life, but that was not Ahab's problem. Jezebel's wife said to him, "Do you now reign over Israel? Are you king? Arise, eat bread, and let your heart be joyful, and I will give you the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite." So she wrote letters in Ahab's name and sealed them with his seal and sent letters to the elders and the nobles who were living with Naboth in his city. And she wrote in the letters saying, "Proclaim a fast. Seat Naboth at the head of the people. Seat two worthless men before him and let them testify against him, saying, you curse God and the king." So while you're having this church service, sit two worthless people there and let them come forward and accuse him of cursing God and the king in the service. "Then take him out and stone him to death." So the men of the city, the elders and the nobles who lived in this city, did as Jezebel had sent word to them, just as it was written in the letters which she had sent them. They proclaimed a fast, and they seated Naboth at the head of the people. Then the two worthless men came in and sat before them, and the worthless men testified against him, even against Naboth, before the people, saying, "Naboth cursed God and the king." So they took him outside the city and stoned him to death with stones. And then they sent word to Jezebel saying, "Naboth has been stoned and is dead." And it came about that when Jezebel heard that Naboth had been stoned and was dead, that Jezebel said to Ahab, "Arise, take possession of the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite, which he refused to give you for money, for Naboth is not alive but dead." And it came about when Ahab heard that Naboth was dead, Ahab rose, go down to the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite, take possession of it. Now, Jezebel, Ahab's princess bride from Sidonia, was an accomplished politico, a schemer, and a witch of Astarte. Is that all that's bothering you? You are the king. Don't you know how to fix things like this, O king? Act like one. "Let me show you how it's done, my weak husband." She wrote letters in Ahab's name to the elders of the Naboth city. And, you know, this evil that is coming from out of the palace could not have gone forward without the cooperation of the leaders of the city. So you know, it's what happens is that the wickedness spreads. It moves down, but it spreads because people participate in it. They don't stand up against it. So proclaim a holiday, set Naboth out in front in place of honor, get two guys to lie about him. We talked about all this. Then take him out and stone him to death. He said, now that's how it's done where I come from, Ahab dear. The city elders did exactly as instructed. Once Naboth was dead, Jezebel told Ahab, now go take the vineyard that you wanted, which Naboth would not sell you. And of course he did, set the bar of evil even higher than it had been in Israel. So all of these kinds of actions just keep raising the bar about what you can do, what you can get away with, how things ought to be done, what is the new Torah, the new operating principles in the land. We have in our own culture many business practices that are widely accepted that are displeasing to the Lord, because what happens is they hurt the people at the expense of profits that are above and beyond what are necessary. You know, I've been in business for many, many years, and we all know what downsizing is. It's been my task on many occasions to downsize people when we acquire companies, and it's ugly. One of the things that we've done is to provide with very good severance packages and stuff like that. But it's anyway you cut it, it's ugly. And what happens with in this environment, especially when you have these publicly traded companies, is companies are making a certain amount of profit, and they want to make more profit for a lot of reasons. All of you who are in business understand the levers, but especially if you're in the first 8 quarters of an IPO, you've got to show constant profits and increase in profits, or else your stock isn't any good. And then what happens is all the people who invested in you don't get their money out of it at the rate that they want. But in order to maximize profits for the shareholders, they will skin down the number of employees. They'll downsize the number of employees, because cutting employees expense is one of the best levers for increasing profits. It's easy. What happens then is the people who are left behind usually have to work double. And they will do so because everybody else is getting laid off, is in worse shape than they are. They want to keep the job. And so we have a scenario in our country, in our culture, where people work extraordinarily long hours because they have to. They don't have a lot of choice in order to be able to put bread on their table. What we don't have is a lot of parents at home who need to be home but can't because they or both of them are out there working in this particular environment. Now, that increases the profits for the stockholders, and in many cases, that's you and me because we own that stock. But it decreases the life, the quality of life for the people who work, not to mention the people who got laid off and are now in the unemployment line and all that sort of thing, and their sense of well-being is devastated, and their children go hungry, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All those things go on. Now, that's the way it's done. That's the way it's done. This is very common business practice. We do it every day, and we consider it to be just okay. That's the way it's done. We don't stop and think about the ramifications of it. Were we to accept a little less profit, we would have people working, more people working. The people who are working would work less hard. They would have the opportunity to go home and raise their family, which would increase our ability in the culture to raise up children. And all of that would be a blessing, even if we didn't make quite as much profit. You know, the idea of maximizing profit is just consumerism at a high level. It's just greed. It's what it is. Remember, Michael Douglas said, greed is good. That's the basic operating principle in business, and that's the way it's done. So, you know, there are consequences to the way we do this business, and there's fallout, and the fallout is in terms of people. It's in terms of people. You know, it's easier to see that when it happens to be your son or your job. It's easier to see that when you realize that fathers can never get home or mothers can never get home because they owe their soul to the company store. So that's a cultural thing that we as a people live with every day. We consider it to be normal. We consider it to be the way it's done. And for that reason, God is hammering on us, because we have not considered the needs of all of the people is more important than the profit. There's a bias in the Bible for capitalism. as against socialism. Clear, pure and simple. People are supposed to work hard and prosper from their work, and we're not supposed to beg, you know, or we're not supposed to try to, you know, be lazy and not work. Paul said, if you don't work, you don't eat. Begging was actually considered a job in the Old Testament, so a beggar was a person who was out trying to make a living, so begging was fine, but expecting other people to support you, and voluntarily quitting your work, whatever, that was, you didn't give people those any support or whatever. So we have a culture which wants to which values money and profit more than it does people, and it's not right. We are dealing with that in terms of its ramifications. I mean, if it's in terms of our children don't know the Lord, or our children don't have help with their schoolwork, and so they're dumb as stumps. Our ability to participate in the economic markets is failing because our children are not the smartest people anymore. Their values are being eroded and corroded by what they see above them. All of this stuff rots a society, and it rots a culture. And we have the levers to fix this if we would. But part of what it means is we would have to say, well, I'm not going to make as much profit, but I'm also not going to lay off all these people. And the people who are here are going to be able to go home after 50 hours or 45 hours or 40 hours or whatever it is that's appropriate. And so we'll all agree to make less so that other people will make something. And then what we'll have is the benefit of a culture reflecting in that. First, you first.
A good example of a company that does not do that is
Chick-fil-A. Yeah.
Closing on Sundays.
Yeah.
Well,
Chick-fil-A has made a statement in that regard, and other companies will do things like they'll carry people during hard times, as opposed to laying them off or whatever. But you know, very often what happens is they have to go private to do that. You'll see companies do that; they'll go private in order to not have to deal with the pressures of the marketplace that put them in a bad place. Yes, Demi? Well, it spirals. It spirals, and like as you said, it spirals. And the thing is that we as Christians have to take responsibility for this. We have to realize this is our culture. This is our fault because we're participating in it at certain levels. So at the very least, we need to begin to seek the Lord that He would create more justice in our culture. We need to realize that what we're doing to ourselves is like taking a diet of strychnine on a regular basis, and it'll eventually kill us. This is the hard stuff, because we have to realize. Now, I tell you what this is kind of like. This is kind of like maybe 50 years ago when everybody around you was using the N-word and you thought, you know, we ought not to be doing that. For you to take that position, especially anyway publicly, caused you to look weird to the culture around you. But what happened is some people got to the place where they felt like it was worth standing up for. And eventually what happened is we quit doing that, at least on the level that we were. Our prejudicial behavior, our injustice toward blacks quit being so systemic. You know, remember, it wasn't that long ago when we had troops preventing students from entering into schools just because that they were black. Now, that seems bizarre to us right now, or at least wrong, but it seemed absolutely right to the culture at the time. Absolutely right. People were absolutely sure this is what God's plan was. Well, we have the capacity for self-deception, a great capacity for it. And one of the things that we need to do is carefully and thoughtfully seek the Lord about where is injustice around us and what is it that can we do. Can we fix it? No, not all of it. Can we fix even a big part of it? Probably not. But if it doesn't start getting fixed in the individual hearts of the Church of Jesus Christ, there's no chance it'll ever get fixed at all. So when people begin to move away from certain attitudes about social justice, like, you know, for instance, the way that we treated blacks for a long time, systemically and with the law on our side, when they began to move away from that to create a society that doesn't do that or doesn't do it anymore, or at least it's not the law or whatever, then those people are sensing the rot and they're saying, we need to fix this. Well, there's a lot of rot. There's a lot of rot. So at the very least, we need to understand what it is we're doing, what we're thinking, and what all it means. Now, The Lord has been very good to most of us, and we have a lot of money. We may not think we do, but if you look around the world, we have a lot of money. And that money that has come to us, it has come by various means. I'm a stockholder. I own stocks. And so a lot of the money that's come to me is, I'm sure, corrupted by much of the greed that's in the society. Part of my job is to redistribute it, to get it out to where the people need it in order to try to come up with a sense of more fairness, more justice, more whatever. So, you know, this is what the prophets are trying to say to us. You as a people have become systemically corrupt, and instead of working against it, you're jumping on the bandwagon to help it. Remember that in Israel, in Isaiah 3, God began to prophesy against the women of Israel. And it was very unusual for God to prophesy against the women because they usually had no power. So he would prophesy against the men, and the women would kind of be sort of stuck doing whatever the men wanted. But women have always had the power of influence. And whenever you look at a culture where the men are kind of insensitive to what's going on, in a good culture, you see the women going around behind, teaching the children, bringing the health care, feeding the poor, doing the kinds of things that need to be done. It used to be the job of the wealthy people in the village to go visit the poor and make sure they all had what they needed. It was the job of the rich people to do that. They didn't work or anything. So they went and visited the poor and took care of people. And people whose hearts were in the right place made sure that no one in the village was, in need beyond a certain point anyway, that they had the basic needs that that were required of them. When God began to rebuke the women in Isaiah, it was because, and we went through that whole thing before about the Diller's chapter, because they had abandoned their role as a mediator against the insensitivity of their men. They had abandoned their role as people who went in and tried to mitigate against the injustice in the community, and jumped on the bandwagon of consumerism, to where it's kind of like, they were helping their husband steal from the poor as opposed to mediate against that. So God spoke against the women. We saw that. So the systemic behavior in a culture is what brings God against the culture. It's what gets people into exile. Let's see. Where am I here? So let's see. How about the city elders did exactly as Jezebel instructed. Once Naboth was dead, Jezebel told Ahab, "Now go take the vineyard you wanted, which Naboth would not sell to you." And Ahab did as he was instructed, and he set the bar even higher than it had been in Israel, to be followed more and more by ruthless businessmen. Bad leadership leads a nation astray and redefines the ethics and morals of a people. If we do not cling to biblical morals, we too will be led down the path of destruction. Today we sometimes call this eminent domain. Right? Eminent domain. We need this for something, whatever, and we're just going to take it away from you or whatever. Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite, saying, "Arise and go down to meet Ahab, the king of Israel, who is in Samaria. Behold, he's in the vineyard of Naboth, where he has gone to take possession of it." Elijah the Tishbite, we all know Elijah. Elijah was a very famous prophet who did battle against the 400 prophets of Baal and the 700 prophets of Astarte on top of Mount Carmel. And we all heard that story, and ran alongside the chariot, carping at the king and all that sort of thing. Elijah, who demanded or declared it would not rain until he said so again, etc., etc. Elijah was a very aggressive prophet against the behaviors of God. And like most non-written prophets, his stories are told in the historic books. And he usually spoke against the violation of the first command, great commandment, to love the Lord your God with your whole heart, mind, soul. In other words, he spoke against idolatry. But in this particular case, God sends Elijah the Tishbite to speak against the violation of neighbor. You shall speak to him, saying, "Thus says the Lord, have you murdered and also taken possession?" You shall speak to him, saying, "Thus says the Lord, in the place where the dogs lick up the blood of Naboth, the dogs shall lick up your blood, even yours." So here's the deal. What you do unto others will be done unto you. So where the dogs licked up Naboth's blood, they will lick up yours as well. And it gets better. Ahab said to Elijah, "Have you found me, O my enemy?" And he answered, "I have found you because you have sold yourself to do evil in the sight of the Lord. Behold, I will bring evil upon you, and will utterly sweep you away, and will cut off from Ahab every male, both bond and free in Israel, and I will make your house like the house of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, the son of the house of Baasha, the son of Ahijah, because of the provocation which you have provoked me to anger, because you have made Israel sin. And Jezebel also has the Lord, and of Jezebel also the Lord has spoken, saying, the dogs shall eat Jezebel in the district of Jezreel. The one belonging to Ahab who dies in the city, the dogs will eat. The one who dies in the field, the birds of the heaven will eat. In other words, the vultures. So this shady little land deal got God's personal attention. This indicates how important it was to God. God sent Elijah to confront Ahab personally about it. He said, because you murdered Naboth to gain this land, the dogs will lick your blood upon this very site. And Ahab's response is, well, how did you find out about this? You know, how did you find out about this? David would have acknowledged his sin and repented in ashes on the spot. Elijah said, I found out you out because your evil was significant to God. God sees. What we read earlier in Psalms, you know, the Lord sees the behaviors of the people. He sees what's going on. Now, every male descendant of Ahab, bound or free, will be killed because you stole Naboth's posterity, reaping and sowing. In other words, because you killed Naboth and stole the life out of his descendants, then every descendant of yours will also be destroyed and consumed by the dogs and by the vultures. I will destroy your lineage because you have destroyed Naboth's lineage, as I did Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, as I did to Baasha, the son of Ahijah, because this is a big sin. The dogs will eat also the body of Jezebel on this site. In the city, the dogs will eat Ahab's offspring. In the country, the vultures will eat Ahab's descendants. All right, now a certain man, this is 1 Kings 22. What's happening here is Ahab has gone to war against Syria. You remember Syria, that little country that we're fighting with right now? By the way, did y'all notice in the news a while back that the Christian group in Syria had joined with the government of Assyria against the rebels? Did y'all notice that? What's happened is the Christians in Assyria have tried to stay neutral out of this fight between the government, Assad, and all of these rebels that have come in. But of course, the rebels that have come in initially were Assyrians. Now they're heavily influenced by Al-Qaeda, who's come in because they're trying to create, take over the land once Assad is gone and create a Muslim state. Well, of course, they don't have anything to do with having a group for Christians, so they started to attack Christians who had been neutral up to this point. And so the Christians have joined themselves with the government to save their own lives, to fight against the rebels. Now, those Christians that we're talking about there, did y'all see that in the paper? I just wanted you to notice it, because this is a community. It's right near the capital there. That's all Christian in this particular area. Those Christians are the direct descendant of the church that Paul founded in Acts 13. The first Gentile church in Acts 13 came from that group right there. This is where Barnabas and Paul raised up a church, the first Gentile church. Those Christian people we're talking about are their direct descendants. That's who it is that's being attacked there right now. So Ahab goes out to battle against Assyria. Now a certain man drew his bow at random, and he struck the king of Israel in the joint of his armor. So he said to the driver of his chariot, that's Ahab, turn around and take me out of the fight, for I'm severely wounded. And the battle raged that day, and the king was propped up in his chariot in front of the Arameans, another name for Syrians, and died at evening, and the blood from the wound ran into the bottom of the chariot. When a cry passed out, the army closed to sunset, saying, every man to his city, every man to his country. So the king died and was brought to Samaria, and they buried the king in Samaria. And they washed the chariot by the pool of Samaria, and the dogs licked up his blood. Now the harlots bathe themselves near in this particular place, according to the word which the Lord had spoken. So where they cleaned out the chariot was right there at the vineyard of Naboth. Remember his vineyard was right beside the king's summer house. And so the dogs came and licked it up. Verse 21 of 2 Kings 9. Then Joram is one of the Well, let's see. Let me go to Rome number 4. So after Elijah had come, Ahab was drawn by God into a war with Syria. He was lured by God into this war with Syria. In a cowardly manner, he dressed up as a common soldier, fearing rightly that the enemy would target him as king. Now, he also lured the king of Judah, Jehoshaphat, to come and fight with him. And the king of Judah did, but shouldn't have. The king of Judah wore royal robes as he fought. And when the archers of Syria saw him, they thought it was Ahab. And so they pressed in to kill him because they were trying to cut off the head of the snake. Well, what happened is they soon realized it was Jehoshaphat, not Ahab. So they let him go. But then some archer at random just launched an arrow in the air, and it pierced into the armor, in a chink in the armor, and to kill Ahab. A random arrow pierced him through the heart, and he bled out in his chariot trying to escape. They washed off the blood in the field of Naboth and Jezreel, and the dogs came and lapped it up. All right, now Joram. Joram is the son of Ahab. Then Joram said, "Get ready." And they made his chariot ready. And Joram, king of Israel, and Ahaziah, the king of Judah, went out, each in his chariot. And they went to meet Jehu and found him in the property of Naboth the Jezreelite. Now, some of you remember this, that when Elijah had sort of gotten to the end of his days and he was discouraged, and he came to the cave out in the wilderness, and he said, "There's nobody but me, Lord, that's faithful anymore." And God said, "You know, you're done, because you've lost heart for all of this. I've got 7,000 men who haven't bowed the knee to me, but you're a good guy. So here's what you're going to do: you're going to go do 3 things for me, and then I'm going to bring you home." Now remember, God takes Elijah to heaven physically and bodily without dying. There's 2 people that happens with, Enos and Elijah. So one of the things that he was supposed to do was to go out and anoint Jehu, the king over Israel, to, in other words, to take over the house of Ahab. And so Jehu came and brought his army out against Joram. So he went and he met Jehu and found him in the property of Naboth the Jezreelite. It came about that when Joram saw Jehu, he said, "Is it peace, Jehu?" And he answered, "What peace, so long as the harlotries of your mother Jezebel and her witchcrafts are so many?" So Joram reigned about and fled and said to Ahaziah, "This is treachery, O Ahaziah." And Jehu drew his bow in full strength and shot Joram between his arms. And the arrow went through his heart, and he sank in his chariot. Jehu said to Bidkar, his officer, "Take him up and cast him into the property of the field of Naboth the Jezreelite. For I remember when you and I were riding together after Ahab his father, that the Lord lay his oracle against him. So surely I have seen yesterday the blood of Naboth and the blood of his son, says the Lord. I will repay you in this property, says the Lord. Now then take him and cast him in the property according to the word of the Lord." So Joram the son of Ahab and Jezebel was wounded in battle with Jehu, subsequently executed Joram by the command of the Lord, had his body dumped in the field of Naboth of Jezreel, where the dogs came and ate his flesh. That's part of the story on. Ahaziah, Joram's brother, another son of Ahab and Jezebel, reigned in Judah only 2 years, suffered a freaky fall and died after being cursed by Elisha the prophet, who was the successor of Elijah. Another Ahaziah, son of Joram and Athaliah, Jezebel's daughter, was slain by Jehu when he killed Joram and was buried in Jezreel with Joram. Finally, Jehu ordered the execution of the 70 sons of Ahab. The elders of Israel delivered 70 heads of Jehu in Jezreel. And Jehu buried them along with the rest of their family there in the vineyard of Naboth. Fulfilling the prophecy from God through Elisha about the extension of Ahab's house. Now, 2 Kings 9. This is the story of the demise of Jezebel.
You said there were 3 things that Elijah had to do.
Well, one was to anoint Elisha as the king, as his successor prophet. The second one was to anoint Jehu as the king over Israel. And the third one was to anoint someone the king over Syria. But I've forgotten at this moment who it is. But there was the 3 things he had to do. All right. Now in the 11th year of Joram, the son of Ahab, Ahaziah became king over Judah. And when Judah came to Jezreel, Jezebel heard about it, and she painted up her lips and rolled and curled her tinted hair. She painted her eyes and adorned her head and looked out the window. As Jehu entered the gate, she said, Is it well, Zimri, your master's murderer? Then he lifted up his face to the window and said, Who is on my side? Who? So what's happened is the king of Judah has surrounded the palace in Jezreel of Jezebel, and she's up in the upper part of it on the tower, and she's hollering down to find out whether or not they're going to have peace or war. And so what happened is, I think it's Ahaziah. He is saying, whoever is for me, I need you to join me now. Okay? And so who's on my side? And two or three officials looked down at him. And in other words, this is Jezebel's officials. And they said, we're with you. And so he said, well, throw her down. And they threw her down, and because of her blood, some of her blood was sprinkled on the wall, on the horses, and he trampled her underfoot. When he came in, he ate and drank, and he said, See now to this cursed woman and bury her, for she is a king's daughter. This is Ahaziah. And they went to bury her, but they found no more of her than the skull and the feet and the palms of her hands. Why? Because the dogs had consumed the rest of her. Therefore, they returned and told him, and he said, This is the word of the Lord, which he spoke by his servant Elijah the Tishbite, saying, In the property of Jezreel the dogs shall eat the flesh of Jezebel, and the corpse of Jezebel shall be dung on the face of the field of the property of Jezreel. So they cannot say, This is Jezebel. In other words, she is no more. So Jezebel is going to get spread out all over the field as after it passes through the dogs of the area. Okay? The pièce de résistance of all of this was the death of Jezebel herself. In defiance of Jehu, she called for her supporters to rally around her. Instead, they sided with Jehu and threw her down from an upper window. She was broken asunder and run over by Jehu's horsemen. Finally, the dogs came and consumed her body, leave only her skull, her hands, and her feet. This point is worth making. God hates the oppression of the poor. God despises big business practices that steal people's lives and labors. God hates unjust judges and wicked governors who bend the law and abuse their authority to steal a man's bread. I mean, one of the things we talk about sometimes in this country is the corruption of our leadership at the top. But one of the things that we fail to appreciate, I think, sometimes, is that that more than just the corruption at the top is the corruption of the judicial system that all of that has caused to come about. Because what's happening is the people who win the top get to appoint the judges, and then the judges will judge according to what the people at the top want. And so people are being badly treated by not just the executive branch of the country, but by the judicial branch as well. We'll talk about this more in just a minute. God will avenge the widow, the alien, the orphan, up to and including the destruction of the nation. God will avenge the widow, the orphan, the alien, up to and including destruction of the nation that lets it happen and participates in its practice. It is the intention of God that there will be rich people. There's nothing wrong with having wealth, but we must recognize what part of our wealth belongs to the poor. We must see that we are God's bank and storehouse where He stores His resources for good work. All right. Now, we have a monolithic culture that's huge. It's bigger than we can all move overnight, and it's bigger than any one of us can move at all. We see a corruption that goes to the very top. One of these days, we may, if we're fortunate, see some repentance coming through the top of our country. I tell you how you know it'll happen, okay? The senators and the congressmen will no longer take advantage of the law. They will say, we will live under the same laws that you do. Okay? We will no longer exempt ourselves from the law because it's just not right. We will lose the politicos that we have now in favor of statesmen. You've got to remember that in times past, there were many people who served as senators and congressmen down through our 200-year history for nothing and took advantage of no programs because they were wealthy. Remember that there was a bias in the early part of our country for the wealthy to be the governing class, and they did it for nothing. They didn't take a salary from all of this. So when we see the people at the top begin to behave in a way that's appropriate and proper, we can have some hope that the kingdom of God is actually a move afoot in our land again. When we see, for instance, that the judges that are appointed are people who are men and women of good character and all of that, then we can have some hope that our culture is turning around. Now, it's monolithic. It's huge. And it's one of those things where you think, it's just too big. You just can't do it. Well, if I thought that was true, what I would do is try to figure out which country I wanted to move to. Because if we don't move and act as a Christian people in the way that we're supposed to, this country is gone. It's just that simple. The mathematics alone tell you that. Just the whole mathematics of the debt system and all that sort of thing. This country cannot survive the practices of the last 40 years. It cannot. Now, we keep hoping that it will. But, you know, you can only print so much money to cover it over. Eventually, it's just mathematics. It doesn't work. Then there is the cultural corruption that is so pervasive that most of the things that we considered godly growing up are now considered foolish and stupid. And most of the things that we considered sinful growing up are now considered culturally appropriate. And if you speak out against that, you're just old fogey. You're just from another age. You don't get it. So this culture and the way it's rotting is headed for destruction. But I don't believe that we have to be there. I don't believe it has to go there. And one of the reasons I don't believe it has to go there is because four times in our country it's been like this, and four times God brought revival. And each time it gave us another 60 to 100 years of walking before the Lord. So it can be done. The second thing is the problem is so big and monolithic that the only way it can be fixed is supernaturally. I have no hope that we can, in the natural, go out and create some solutions for all of this. Now, I'm all for people voting, and I'm all for people studying the candidates and picking what is usually the lesser of two evils, and doing whatever they can in that regard, lobbying for the things they feel right about, pro-life or whatever it is you feel good about. I'm all for those kinds of things, but I have no hope in the political system that it has the ability to fix all this, because if we had a party of nothing but righteous men, they couldn't function in the atmosphere where they are because the levers of power are in the hands of the corrupt. So, you'd have to, first of all, you'd have to elect 300 congressmen who were righteous men and women, and you'd have to elect 51 senators who are righteous men and women. And I'm not talking about people who go to church. I'm talking about people who believe in God and His Word, are willing to obey it and stand up against it and speak out against it. Now, how many of those can get elected that way? In our culture, not many of them. They have to sneak through by accident, or they have to get religion once they get there, because it's just against it. So what we need, the only thing will work, is the hand of God, the supernatural hand of God. But I believe in the hand of God. I believe in the supernatural hand of God that He can move among us. So what it is, can we do? Because we can't move the big monolithic structure. Well, what we can do is we can each of us behave in our own life in a manner that is consistent with what God would want us to do. I can't feed all the poor, but I can feed the poor that God shows me. I can't provide justice for all the people, but I can provide justice for the people that God shows me. I want to stand before the Lord someday. Remember, I want to be God's friend. We've talked about this before. And I want to stand before the Lord, and when I do, I want Him to be able to say, I gave you a lot, and what you did is you took it and you did what you could to work against the injustice that was going on, the false distribution of wealth that was out there. You did what you could. You had a program. We should have an identifiable program. All right, this is the money I spend on the poor here in this country, and this is the money I spend on the foreign poor, and this is the money I spend on helping people at church, and this is the money I spend on. We should have a program, a fixed program, that says these are the things that I'm doing with the money that God has given me. And then our only question is going to be, is it enough? Is it enough? So this story that we read today is a classic example of the way that it works in the real world. In any culture, in any place, and we can all see the arrogance of Jezebel, the weakness of Ahab, the misuse of power to get them something they wanted but didn't need. The taking it away from someone who is righteous, even to the point of destroying their life. And by the way, no judge steps up for them. You know, no judge steps up for them. You know, in our country, one of the things we still have going for us is judges can defy presidents. And the question is will they? Right now, what we have is a lot of judges who are defying God. So, just something to think about. When the prophets are speaking to us, this is what they're saying to us. These are the things that they're saying. And what we need to do is not say, well, it's just so big I couldn't possibly fix it. It is too big for me to fix. We just need to be asking ourselves, what is it that I'm doing, you know, building the wall in front of my house? What is it that I'm doing with what God has given me? That's what I will be held responsible for. And the truth of the matter is if we get enough people doing that, that will have an impact on the community. That will have an impact. It'll expand and roll out. You know what happens when people jump in to help out in a crisis? In this country, whenever some huge crisis happens, the people who actually make the most impact on getting things fixed are the ordinary people, the church disaster teams, the people who get in their cars and take their trucks and take their chainsaws up to Dalton or where it is, pitch in and help out. It's businesses who are in there. You know, we spend $2 million a year caring for the poor in our business. It's business in private sector. It's not the government. Even if the government wants to do something, it has no capacity to do it. They'll park about 1,000 trailers in Homestead, Florida, which no one can use, and they're full of asbestos, and never gets to anybody because the process of getting them out there is so complex nobody can get there. They'll provide all kinds of aid that no one can access. And what they'll do is they'll stand in the way of the people who do. We had to go to Washington to find a couple of senators who would help us get gasoline trucks through the state patrol and the federal cops into Ochsner Medical Center so we could get their generators going. We had gasoline fuel trucks full of fuel that we had driven, that we paid for, had driven to Louisiana, to Ochsner Medical Center, the only functioning hospital in Katrina, and we were trying to get that to them so they could keep their generators going. And the state and the federal government were going, well, you know, we need 23 pieces of paper on this, and we need signatures from 83 people and whatever. And, you know, I mean, it was impossible to get it done. So we had to finally go to people we had leverage with who were senators and congressmen and get them to send the word down, let those trucks through. And we got through. But that's how we did it. We had to leverage the political system to do it because the government was not equipped to be able to help us in that particular environment. So, just something to think about. I need to quit here. Yes, son. Okay, we gotta go. Somebody pray us out.